from KUER News in Salt Lake City. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Over the last several years now, Utah's had one of the lowest voter turnout rates in the country. Robert Gerke of the Salt Lake Tribune says when you look at the way the state's political boundaries have been drawn, it's no wonder. Gerke looked at all the races for legislature in the last three election cycles, and he found that only 14 of these races were remotely competitive. In 59 of them, no one ran against the incumbent. No one. In so many races in this state, if you're a voter, you'd be forgiven for thinking, what's the point? Today in the program, we're talking about the way we draw political boundaries in this state. Gerrymandering is the word you hear from time to time. There's a group of Democrats and Republicans who are trying to change the process in Utah. So we'll talk about how redistricting is supposed to work and how it really does. Join us after the news.
Take Radio West wherever you go with KUER's mobile app for Android and iPhone. Public radio is always a swipe away with KUER's mobile app, free and available for download right now in your mobile phone's app store.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. There are a few ballot initiatives in the works for next year. This is when these groups collect signatures to get ideas on the ballot. They put them directly to voters. One group is trying to raise taxes to pay for public education. Another group is trying to get medical marijuana legalized. These ballot measures are kind of a workaround for citizens who are not happy with lawmakers when they didn't pass something these groups think they should have or when they passed something they think they shouldn't have. The latest ballot initiative comes from a group called Utahns for Responsive Government. It's made up of Democrats and Republicans who are trying to change the way the state redraws its political boundaries. They say right now, the way the boundaries have been fine-tuned and altered and shifted, it's the politicians who are choosing their voters, not the other way around, as it's supposed to be. They're still working out the details, but they're hoping to collect enough signatures to get a plan on the ballot that would basically strip out the partisan nature of the process, if that's possible. It might not be, and this is not going to be easy. And all of this got us thinking of how this is supposed to work anyway. How does that ideal compare with reality? We're hoping to hear from you today. You can join us. 801-585-WEST is the number. 801-585-9378. Our email address, radiowest@kuer.org. Your own questions that you might have. Some of this stuff is kind of basic. We have a lot of questions. You may too. Or comments about the process, the way you think it's been working. Do you feel in any way disenfranchised by the process? Again, 801-585-WEST, the number to join us. Joining us first on the program, Robert Gerke, who's a columnist for the Salt Lake Tribune. He's been writing about this process lately, and we invited him to join us to sort of work through some of this. And Robert Gerke, welcome. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Tim Chambliss is also with us. He's the academic outreach coordinator for the Hinckley Institute of Politics here at the University of Utah. He recently retired as an associate professor of political science after almost 30 years. Congratulations, by the way.
Thank you. Happy to be here.
And welcome to you. Thanks for being with us. We'll get to some history stuff with Professor Chambliss here in just a moment. Robert Gerke, I wanted to start with you, though. And I want to go back to 2011, because it seems like this, at least for this part of the story, is kind of the relevant year. This is when lawmakers went in with the benefit now of this, as I understand it, really sophisticated computer technology and started fine-tuning boundaries.
Right. They have this software now. Every 10 years, they redraw these state legislative districts, congressional districts, based on the census numbers. And they've got this software now that's basically off-the-shelf software, costs about $5,000.
Oh, really?
And they run these programs out of the state party headquarters, both the Democrats and the Republicans. And they can move the boundaries by, you know, a street over, a precinct over, and get immediately have a spit out the voter registration, voter data. And so they have this tool now that they can draw these districts, not just on what they think the partisan breakdown of them might look like, but on very detailed, you know, house by house, block by block readouts. And it's actually, you know, as we look ahead to 2021, this data is getting so much more sophisticated that they now combine it with, you know, it's almost more of a marketing thing where they use it based on what you buy, and it's predictive on what how you are expected to vote. And it's incredibly accurate. And so, you know, when they have those tools at their disposal, they can fine tune these districts to the point where they have a pretty good idea if it's going to be a Republican district or a Democratic district. And
based on what? The way they voted before?
Based on registration, the way people have voted in the past, yeah. So as we were doing going through this exercise in 2011, every time a new map would come out, they'd, you know, spit it out down to the party headquarters and run the numbers again and get an idea. Actually, it got to the point they'd post them online, immediately pull them down, you know, download them into the software, and it would tell them exactly what the partisan breakdown of these districts was going to be. And so what you ended up with were these districts that, are either not competitive, they're either very safe for Republicans or Democrats. It's almost incumbent retention in a certain way. And for the last several years, for the last three election cycles since these boundaries were put into place, we've had very, very few competitive elections. I was actually a little surprised to run the numbers. We have about 90 state legislative elections between the House and the Senate every year. So of the 271 elections we've had in the last three election cycles, there have only been 14 competitive House races. There have been 58 races that were completely, there was no opponent in November. And so what you end up with is a situation where these voters, unless you live in one of those 14 districts, where their votes simply don't matter. There were zero competitive Senate races in the last three cycles. So you have a situation where the voters' votes don't matter. And you also have a situation where, because the elections are decided in the primary cycle or in the convention cycle, those are the only voters that the representatives have to keep happy if they want to keep their job. And so,
which means they don't have to listen to moderates.
They don't have to listen to moderates. They don't have to listen to Democrats. They don't have to listen to anybody who might not support them, because come November, the elections are already over. As long as they keep the delegates happy, they're going to get reelected. In my opinion, this is and the opinion of these people who are now proposing an initiative to change the way we do the redistricting, you end up with a government that's not responsive to the average Utahn. We've talked about it before on this program, but the delegates are in both parties are more strident and more partisan and more polarized than the mainstream Utahns. And so you have a legislature that I think doesn't necessarily reflect the average Utah's views and is not representative. And you know, we also kind of have to talk about what are elections for. And elections are really the only check that people have on their elected officials, barring impeachment, I guess. And so if these elections aren't really a check on the elected officials, then how is government actually matter? We're sort of one small step away almost when you have the vast majority of elections that don't actually matter. We're one small step away from North Korea. You know, I mean, we're go through the charade of having these elections every November, but at the end of the day, they're kind of meaningless.
This seems like a silly question because the state is overwhelmingly Republican, mm-hmm. but does the same sort of thing happen for Democrats too? I mean, they do. They're not by any stretch a majority, but they have their safe districts too.
It does. So there's a strategy when they do these redistricting exercises, and it's they've got it down to a science. It's called pack them or crack them. And so the Democrats get packed into these little enclaves up in the avenues, on the east, yeah, in the foothills, and you know, sort of downtown Salt Lake, where they're clustered together. And those are very safe districts. In the last election, about half of the Democrats who actually won elections in the last cycle were also unopposed. So it works on both sides of the partisan divide. And I think that's probably part of the reason why there hasn't been more of a push by the Democrats to change the way we do this. Representative Rebecca Chavez-Houck has sponsored a bill to create an independent commission to try to draw less partisan boundaries.
She's tried this a few times.
She tried it for 2 years. The last time she did it, it didn't even get out of it didn't even get a committee hearing. The time before that, it was defeated in the House. And so, you know, so the system serves the incumbent Democrats to some extent too, I think. And so that's why you now have this group that we'll talk about, I'm sure, with Mayor Becker and former Mayor Ralph Becker and a Republican partisan party activist named Jeff Wright, who are trying to do a ballot initiative to create an independent commission, an advisory commission, really, more than anything, that would provide input on how we draw these boundaries in the future.
We should also mention, in terms of one of the effects of this redistricting plan years ago, was they carved up the congressional district.
Right.
That it was possible for a Democrat to win a congressional district in this state for a time, and then they did what some see as this kind of cynical move of basically crafting a district where none of the members of Congress actually live in Salt Lake County.
Yeah, I mean, that was the other part. I guess I said Packham and Crackham. I explained the Packham part.
The Crackham
part.
This is the
Crackham part, where they took Salt Lake County and split it into pieces.
Jim Matheson
Jim Matheson's district got carved up, and they actually put him into a district that he hadn't represented before. You've got, as a result, all of these Salt Lake County Democrats. It's Salt Lake County is fairly evenly split, Democratic and Republican. All of these Salt Lake County Democrats who would go out and vote, but they don't really have a chance of having a Democrat win the election. We've got, I believe the fourth district, the seat Mia Love holds now, is a 13-point Republican advantage. I think Chris Stewart's was about a 12-point Republican advantage. And then you've got the Chaffetz and Bishop seats, the former Chaffetz seat and the Bishop seat, which are both considerably higher, I think 17 to 19 points in that area. So they carved it up. So they're, you know, whereas you see in pretty much every statewide election, Democrats get about 25% to 30% of the vote, sometimes usually closer to 25%, but they don't have 1/4 of the representation in Congress as a result of the way they've drawn these boundaries. You know, the Wall Street Journal at the time called it, I think, one of the most cynical examples of gerrymandering in the country in the 2011 cycle.
Tim Chambliss, what is wrong in principle with, we have this sophistication, we have these algorithms, we can go in and fine-tune this process. What's wrong with going in and surgically drawing a congressional boundary to make it fit your partisan inclinations?
Well, the goal is good government. It's supposed to be, in theory. The census, the first census in 1790, we had a population of less than 4 million people in the country. Utah was not yet a state. The goal is to keep the country current for good planning, for taxation, to redraw districts according to the changing demographics of the country. That's the ideal goal, but you're dealing with imperfect people. You're dealing with lawmakers who are politicians, and by definition, what does a politician want? Continued political life. They want to get reelected. And that will mean that they will do what they have to do to get reelected. And that means choosing their own voters very often.
Right. But again, what was the intent? What was the idea? The idea that you would have political parties in rooms going through their, computer programs to fine-tune all of this stuff, does that markedly go against the intent? Was the idea of partisanship even thought about when they were thinking about redrawing districts? Well,
the term political parties does not even exist in the U.S. Constitution. So we don't have political parties. The idea of differing points of view, yes. Political parties, no, when the country was first conceived.
So what does the Constitution say about drawing boundaries? Does it say it shouldn't be for partisan matters? Is it just talking about circumstance and refiguring
Article 1, Section 2 of the Constitution gives the state legislatures the responsibility to redraw districts accordingly. But we remember that George Washington said what we're creating here is an experiment in democracy. He said that at the Constitutional Convention. In 1792, when he was running for re-election, his first veto was a veto of a reapportionment bill in which the northern states, and keep in mind Washington was a southerner from Virginia, the northern states wanted to increase their political power. So they wanted to add members to the House of Representatives. Washington, being a southerner from Virginia, vetoed that bill. He thought that it was unfair. And you remember the three-fifths compromise that inflated the support of southern states anyway. So we had this issue of political partisanship with regard to districts going back to the first years of our country.
Where do we get the name? This might be a civics update for class update for some people. Where do we get the name gerrymandering? This is Elbridge Gerry.
Right, Elbridge Gerry. Not Jerry, but Elbridge Gerry.
I've never understood that. Why isn't that gerrymandering?
How does it change? Okay.
Really, we think of the first years of the 1800s when he was governor of Massachusetts. And he supported drawing of districts that would maintain the influence of people with his point of view. And he was a Boston Brahmin, privileged individual, who actually had been a delegate at the Constitutional Convention earlier in 1787. And he was one of the three delegates to vote no, to not ratify the Constitution. It was approved on a vote of 38-3.
How are you supposed to... the idea of independence is supposed to... I mean, that seems like an ideal. I'm not sure where we locate that in the Constitution, though. So I guess here's the question. How legal is it? Is it legal that what happened in 2011 in Utah? Now, this happened in other places, but let's just focus on that for a moment. Is that legal? Can you find something in the Constitution that says what they did or what they're doing is unconstitutional?
Good people can disagree. Robert talked about the fact that elections serve as a check. So do the courts. And invariably, as de Tocqueville observed years ago, these controversies become legal matters. And what we've seen is in recent years is that the courts have said no, that racially motivated drawn districts are illegal. They're unconstitutional. They violate the 14th Amendment's Due Process Clause and Equal Protection Clause, as well as the 1965 Voting Rights Act and even arguably the First Amendment freedom of expression. We have that disagreement that we can see. We can see racially gerrymandered districts are illegal, but then the question is politically partisan districts. How do you justify this?
The court has not said what they think about that.
The court has tried. 13 years ago in 1994, the court in a case called VF versus Jubilier said that political partisan drawn districts are suspect, but we're not quite sure what to do about it. So the court has stayed away from it until just now.
Yeah.
Just now, the court has accepted a case coming out of the state of Wisconsin dealing with the questionably drawn districts after the 2010 election. It's a case entitled Gill versus Whitford. And we'll see how soon the case will be decided by all nine justices.
Robert, you say this is a big deal, this case.
It is a big deal because, as Tim mentioned, in the past, they've really only given scrutiny to racially gerrymandered districts, the districts that are drawn to disenfranchised minority voters. This is really going to be the first time that they are taking this issue of partisan gerrymandering head on. And it's been interesting because in the last couple of years, there are a couple of political scientists who developed this idea called the efficiency gap, which basically is supposed to measure how many wasted votes or what percentage of the votes in any gerrymander or any district redistricting map are wasted. And in Wisconsin's, the court looked at that and used that as part of the evidence that these districts were suspect. And in Utah, for example, we have the 17th highest efficiency gap, so the 17th highest number of wasted votes.
Wow.
It looks like it's probably cost Democrats in this state about $3.5 billion seats. So we're not talking about flipping the entire political system, but it has had tangible consequences in this instance. In 2011, the Democrats had threatened to sue over the way the map was drawn. They ended up not doing that. This Wisconsin case is going to be, I think, a watershed because it will give some really clear definition heading into 2021 when we go through this exercise again about what is allowable and what isn't.
Any sense you now have a court that's back leaning conservative? Any ideas what Neil Gorsuch, for example, may think about all of that? Too early to say.
You know, My gut tells me that they're probably going to defer to the state legislatures that draw these maps. As Tim mentioned, there is clear constitutional direction for these legislatures to do this. But we have seen, as Tim also mentioned, sort of a progression in sort of additional scrutiny. And the math is pretty clear in this instance, especially the Wisconsin case. It's pretty astonishing how high the gap is between what Democrats should have, you know, how they should be represented in that state and how they actually are represented in that state. And so there's an argument that can be made here that, yes, the legislatures get to draw maps, but no, they don't get to disenfranchise voters. And so that's going to be where this kind of comes to a head. I think a conservative court likes to take a hands-off approach, but
defer to the legislative bodies.
But you know, we'll see how this one plays out.
801-585-WEST is the number to join the conversation. You can send us an email, radiowest@kuer.org. Robert Gerke is with us, a columnist for the Salt Lake Tribune. We have a link to his column about gerrymandering in Utah on our website. You can go there at radiowest.org. Tim Chambliss, academic outreach coordinator for the Hinckley Institute of Politics, recently retired associate professor of political science. We'll take a break, come back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we are talking about redistricting, that is, drawing the boundaries for political districts. And here's why. Robert Gerke was mentioning in an article that he wrote recently that in this state, there have only been 14 races for legislature that have been close, competitive. In the state Senate, he says, there hasn't been one competitive race in three election cycles. And a lot of these races, a lot of them, there isn't even an opponent. So we're talking about how redistricting is supposed to work and how it actually does work. Robert Gerke with the Salt Lake Tribune is with us. Tim Chambliss, former professor of political science at the University of Utah. He's an academic outreach coordinator now for the Hinckley Institute of Politics. He's joining us too. You can join us. 801-585-WEST is the number. Our email address, radiowest@kuer.org. So let's talk a little bit about this ballot initiative. I mean, we'll have more to say as we get more details about it. But Robert Gerke, what do we know? Have they fine-tuned the particulars yet? I know they're working on that.
They are working on that. There's a whole process that they have in place that they're going to they've got to jump through to get this on the ballot still. But the concept is that you create an independent commission that has appointed members. It's bipartisan. And it's essentially would be advisory in its capacity because, as Tim mentioned, it is up to the legislature constitutionally to draw these boundaries. So you can't have a commission that comes in and just imposes its will. But the idea is that you have this commission that draws these boundaries within some parameters. It sets up these parameters where communities of interest, which are, you know, cultural blocks and ethnic communities, are kept intact, where cities and political jurisdictions are respected and kept intact, where districts are contiguous and compact. Those are two of the criteria that they use. And within these various criteria, the commission then goes and crafts the fair boundaries, essentially, and recommends those to the legislature, which then can adopt them or not. I think the idea being that if the legislature then departs from them radically or somehow cynically tweaks these to sort of, you know, to preserve their respective political power, then there's going to be some pressure from voters and pressure from the public to for them not to do that. And they would have to explain, well, why did you, you know, why did you change this district this way and break up this city or whatever? So that's the idea, is just sort of give the legislature a baseline, I guess, that they can that uses these criteria, these sort of more, you know, equitable criteria, and proposes some maps, and they go from there.
So I'm not sure if they've nailed this down yet. I've seen one description of the structure of this potential commission as you would have two Republicans appointed by legislative leadership. You'd have two Democrats appointed by you know, the minority leadership. You'd have two unaffiliated commissioners. One would be chosen by the Republicans, one by the Democrats. So you're staying equal here. You'd have a commission chair appointed by the governor. Now, that would throw you off because the governor's Republican, at least these days. So how would that work if you didn't have that much power, if lawmakers were resistant to the idea of the fact that this, they don't like ballot initiatives for the most part.
Right.
So they're going to be reluctant anyway. You've got this commission that has one more Republican than it has Democrats in the first place. And then they just make this kind of, I don't mean to be disrespectful to it, but it seems like a kind of toothless recommendation to the lawmakers who, by virtue of the Constitution, have all the power to do all of this.
Well, and to be clear, the parameters that they would set these maps by would also apply to the legislature. And so those are the standards they would have to follow when they do adopt their maps ultimately. And if they depart from that radically, then they could be subject to a court challenge on the basis so that, you know, they did split up a city or they did break up a community of interest.
Can they do that?
Yeah. I mean, that's the notion that we're talking about with this Wisconsin case. That could change the landscape a little bit, I guess. But, but you know, if these standards are in place, and there have been legislative proposals to put these standards in place, frankly, just as guide rails for the process as it proceeds. The commission would not be able to, you know, impose its will on the legislature. I think that would probably be, if they tried to do that, I don't think that would work. And constitutionally, you can't change the Utah Constitution through an initiative. So if they did want to go further and try to change the Constitution, they can't do that.
You'd have to amend the Constitution.
You have to amend the Constitution, which would be up to the legislature to do. And then, you know, then you get into the whole issue of them not wanting to give away, you know, hand over the power that they've got. So yeah, they're going as far as they can go. Advisory commission is about as far as they can go on this. But I do think that it would, you know, if the commission gives them map A and the legislature adopts map Z, they've got to explain how they got from those two, you know, between those two points. And I think,
and at least there's more accountability.
There's more accountability, and there is, like I said, the possibility for a legal challenge if they do depart from it.
We do have a recent case study we can look at here in Utah. After the April 1st, 2010 census, the Salt Lake County Council and the mayor supported the creation of a citizens reapportionment advisory commission.
You were on this commission.
I was vice chair, and it was a 7-member commission, and we worked for an entire year during 2011. We came up with 3 plans. When it went to the county council, they tweaked it because they did not want to have 2 incumbent sitting elected members running against each other. In other words, the commission, which represented 40% of the state, was not toothless, but it didn't have sovereignty, didn't have ultimate authority. We could only make a recommendation as a commission. And they listened, and for the most part, they accepted our recommendations.
So you think that's a good thing? That could potentially work?
I think I want something that can – I believe in problem solving. And we see the problem, and now we're looking for the solutions. And I believe that full transparency and active involvement by concerned citizens is something that we've got to pursue.
What was the makeup of that commission?
3 Republicans, 3 Democrats, and a fiercely independent person.
Was the person really fiercely independent?
I think so.
Yeah.
Because you know what? We came up with consensus. We had agreement on all 3 maps that were submitted. All 7 members agreed to those
commissions. I guess that's the question I'm really interested in, is whether or not you can – and we'll go to the Iowa example, because Iowa's one state that has – a process that seems independent anywhere, at least they, but I don't want to get there yet, because here's the principle that I'm interested in. Can you have people who are related to parties knowing that it could affect the success of their party actually behave in independent ways when they're on these commissions?
It's a good question. Iowa, by the way, has the same number of U.S. representatives as Utah. Iowa's been losing population, Utah gaining population. Iowa, when you look at its congressional districts, have real squares and rectangles rather than slithering districts. It's made up.
Explain that. What's the significance of that? I mean, that I guess that seems obvious to some people, but when you have these really squiggly lines, it means people have been doing a lot of
manipulating districts in order so that the incumbent politicians are effectively choosing their voters rather than the voters having the opportunity to choose their candidates for public office.
Go ahead, Robert.
No, I was just going to say, I think you raise a valid question about political independence. And there have been some who suggested, well, if we're going to have an independent commission, why don't we have these commissioners elected in a nonpartisan basis? And I just don't think that works because A, we don't really have nonpartisan elections in the state. We pretend to, but we all know where people's political allegiance is.
Yeah.
And that makes these very high stakes elections, and they're going to be hyperpartisan rather than nonpartisan. So I think the appointed the idea of appointing these commissioners works best. Can they behave without partisan considerations? Maybe not, but we do know the system that we have now is driven almost exclusively by partisan considerations, and that minority party gets steamrolled every time. And so you know, it couldn't be worse than the system we've got in place now. And the other thing I think is, like we talked about with this software, while it's a pretty useful tool too, you can create districts that are incredibly precisely balanced, and you know, by tweaking these precincts like we talked about at the outset, not to gain partisan advantage but to gain balance. And so I think there are tools in place where you can say the data shows that this is a fair district, so that can also be a check on this. I mean, if we go back to the beginning when we were talking about this the way they were using the software, I mean, people were calling the headquarters in a panic saying, what's my district look like? It's like, and it's not their district. It's the people's district, the people they represent. Mm-hmm. And you know, you end up with this cockamamie numbering system where they were fighting over who gets to keep, you know, which district numbers. So instead of having the districts numbered sequentially, you have it jumping around because I used to, you know, my district is the 43rd house district, and I'm going to keep 43. And it's just insanity. So,
Tim, how does it work in Iowa? How have they managed? Because you've talked about this with some reverence, that they've managed to come up with something that approaches independence.
My understanding
or disinterest
in Iowa is you have retired judges who have been confirmed through the political process, but they've been judges. They've gone through the judicial lawmaking process. Now they're retired. They're not seeking public office. They can sit back and they can observe this process with more objectivity than, say, arguably incumbent legislators who go behind closed doors and draw districts that are basically a plan for re-election and non-competition.
And Representative Chavez-Houck's bill, I believe, initially had three judges on this redistricting commission, and maybe that's something that's worth looking at as this thing progresses.
Judges are used to keeping trying to anyway, for the most part.
Yeah, the notion is that that's their job, right?
Yeah, right.
Yeah.
Let me read in, let's see, I guess this is an email from Laurie. She writes, I've voted in every election since I've been able to, since I was 18. Most of the time, my vote, though, has not counted. I'm wondering if I ought to continue to vote. I love being able to do my civic duty. I take it seriously, but what's the point if my vote doesn't count? No matter how many of my like-minded friends do vote, our votes won't ever count. It's frustrating. Seems like, Robert, this is what you were getting at in your article.
Yeah.
I mean, this idea of – and this sense of frustration has to drive voter turnout low.
I mean, if you are waking up on election day and you know the presidential race is decided and the gubernatorial race is not a contest, you don't have actually anybody to vote for in your state legislative race – well, at that point, you know, staying home and watching TV looks pretty good. I mean, there's really no reason to get motivated. And beyond that, there's no reason to get engaged in the campaigns, and there's no reason to knock on doors and be part of the process because, your vote doesn't matter. And we've seen Utah's And frankly, as the state has become more monolithic in its partisan breakdown, we've seen a decline in the voter turnout. And I think there's got to be a correlation there between the two. Will independent districts make a difference? It probably will make a difference. I think it, combined with what we saw Count My Vote trying to do, where they started creating more primaries, I think that was a positive step. The more opportunity you have for voters to participate in a meaningful way and have their votes actually matter, I think there's going to be more voter involvement. And absent those meaningful elections, I think you're going to see a continued decline in voter interest and voter turnout.
What Robert just talked about indicates that we have that our democracy is in danger. That if we have a situation where people are not doing the basic action of good citizenship, and that is to register and to vote, and if voter turnout is continuing to be low, then we see a situation where one out of four, one out of five persons in our country are voting and making the decision for all of us. It puts our country in great jeopardy.
This gets to what you were saying earlier. This is the way this process works in this day right now. By the time mainstream voters, even if you're a Republican, by the time it gets to November and your vote, or when you start paying attention, as most Americans do, right around what, September or October?
Right, the first Monday in November.
Right. The decision's already been made for the most part.
Yeah, no.
And this is what the Count My Vote initiative and those proposals were trying to accomplish is make it. Make it so it's not just the really, as you said, sort of strident party people that are the most involved in the process.
Yeah, I think the Count My Vote process, which just to recap for your listeners, was intended to try to spur voter turnout by giving people a way to gather signatures to get on a primary election ballot. The thinking being that because if we have more primary elections, then voters will have more opportunities to be involved in the process. And it's had mixed results so far. We'll see how it works in this next election cycle.
Well, legislative resistance for sure, and party resistance as well.
Yeah, the party's been challenging it in court. The legislature has been sort of griping about it and kind of trying to undermine it for since it took effect in 2014. So we'll see how it ends up, how that ends up. But I think they kind of maybe just, it's been helpful, but I think maybe misdiagnosed the problem a little bit because you still end up with this situation where, again, most of the races are already decided because of the shape and the makeup of the districts. And so, but the two working in tandem, I think gives voters more opportunities and a more meaningful way to participate in the electoral process.
The initiative process with Count My Vote was an attempt to overcome the apparent problems of the exclusionary process of the caucus convention system. In that way, that process we saw had denied an incumbent governor the opportunity to defend her record, despite high positioning in the public opinion polls, to, in 2004, defend her record in 2010. Bob Bennett, with a very high voter approval record, was denied the opportunity to defend his record on public policy issues. This was seemingly undemocratic, and that's why Count My Vote when the signature process was attempted.
And I think, if I just could briefly, that with this election to replace Jason Chaffetz that we're in the middle of now, Republican delegates picked a very strident conservative partisan in Chris Herod to be their chosen nominee for the out of the convention. Were it not for Count My Vote and a signature path to the ballot, he would probably almost be guaranteed to be Utah's next congressman. And this is somebody who's taken a very hardline position on immigration and a host of other issues and is a bit of a political bomb thrower. But because of Count My Vote, we now have a meaningful primary in coming up in August, and then we have a general election in November. There is some benefit to the Count My Vote. But again, it goes back to what we were saying about how the delegates in both parties, both the Republicans and the Democrat parties, don't really represent the mainstream of Utah. And we've seen this by studies by the Utah Foundation and others, that they have more strident polarized viewpoints, and you know, we've got the Bernie Sanders wing in the Democratic Party, and we've got the super right wing in the Republican Party that make up most of the delegate pools, and also they're not representative, especially in the Republican Party. 75% of them are white male. That's not a representative sampling of your Republican Party.
And this is the thing that creates this discontent that makes people want to do these ballot initiatives, mm-hmm. I guess. Because, I mean, you look at the medical marijuana thing, and you look at political polling related to that. You look at another ballot initiative in the works about giving more taxes, more funding to public education.
Yeah.
Even though the state, of course, goes without saying, leans right, they tend to be more moderate in those ways. And so these ballot initiatives are a way to sort of get around that and get to actual voters. Well, who would want to rule on that?
I think it's a point I tried to make in the column, and is that we see all of these ballot initiatives coming up, as many as five this year coming up. We saw the Count My Vote initiative, and these symbolize the vote of frustration by voters that they don't feel like they're being heard by their legislators. Every voter, you know, every opinion poll that's been done, education is one of the top issues for voters. More money for education, and year after year, the legislature kind of does small steps, but they're not doing what voters want them to do. Medical marijuana polls have shown that people support legalizing medical marijuana, but the legislature for the last couple of years has not taken meaningful steps in that direction, and so there's sort of this frustration that I think is manifesting itself in these voter initiatives, and I think that is both a symptom and maybe spurring this redistricting initiative in particular.
We're not getting many calls, which I wonder what that means. I always worry about whether or not people are actually interested in this. This seems really important
to me. Or
maybe
because they're terribly ambivalent.
Well, that's exactly mm-hmm. it, and maybe a reflection of their frustration. Mm-hmm. Laurie's quote was kind of sad. You know, she's wondering if it even makes any difference mm-hmm. at all.
And it's so important, because what is one's vote? It's the expression of one's beliefs, attitudes, and values, you know, in our democratic process and the way we live our lives, hopefully with freedom.
And I think, and again, I think it's the only safety valve that voters have at their disposal to try to, you know, make sure that the people that are in office represent them, and the people that, if they don't represent them, are voted out of office. And if you can't do either of those things in a meaningful way, then what is our democracy supposed to, how is it supposed to function?
I need to take a break. Let me take a call first, though. Jen has, we do have a few. Jen is joining us from Salt Lake City. Jen, sorry for the wait. Welcome.
No problem. I just wanted to say thanks to everyone here for this really important discussion. Tim, this is Jen Colby. I ran for local office recently, and you're an inspiration for that, partly. Also, I wanted to say to the other caller, it really is important, because these local races are often where there's just a handful of votes that make a difference. Mm-hmm. But I totally understand the challenges, and I heard a lot from people saying, my vote doesn't count. It doesn't matter. Why should I bother? So on that note, I appreciate this idea for solutions for our larger problems with our democratic institutions and our electoral system. A couple quick questions. The gerrymandering is an issue, but we also have had population growth and kept the same number of representatives for a long time. Now, I realize adding politicians isn't necessarily a popular campaign issue, but would it help to have more elected representatives and therefore smaller districts, which would be harder to pack and crack? And also, given, right now is primary season for local offices in Salt Lake City. It's July, people are on vacation, people aren't paying attention. It's really hard to get people to turn out. Would something like a ranked choice voting process just for the main election with some sort of qualifying cutoff help so that we just have one main race, skip the caucuses and primaries, and go for it when people are actually paying attention? Two questions. And other solutions I'd love to hear through the end of the show here. So thanks so much.
Jen, thanks. Glad you called. Thanks a lot. What do you think? Could you?
I think ranked choice voting is a pretty interesting concept. And the notion being that then, instead of having these districts drawn up in the way they are now and gerrymandered the way they are now, you would end up with, you know, this section of the state gets five representatives, and the top five vote getters in the election get to be the, you know, you'd have 15 people on a ballot or whatever, maybe not that many, but it's an interesting concept that mm-hmm. would make it a lot harder to sort of split this up. Now, as far as the increasing the number of legislators, I think that's I think for a state of our population size, 75 House members is probably pretty adequate. I don't know. I know New Hampshire, I think it is, yes, has something like 600. Yes. Yeah, it's
New Hampshire has a population half the size of Utah.
Yeah,
so New England.
And so, well, I mean, the benefit of that is that you end up with people who are very locally engaged, right? If you if you don't like something and you want to talk to your representative, you know exactly who it is, and they probably live two or three houses down. Mm-hmm. If it's not you yourself, so yeah. So I think there it's an interesting notion, but I think, you know, it gets a little unwieldy when you start adding that many people into a legislative body. And I think it, for certain terms of simplicity, I think it probably we're I think the number of legislators and representatives we have now is pretty reasonable.
Yeah. Might say governing is not easy. Governing is hard. We're always looking for the creative solution. I was in Australia recently, and there every citizen who's a qualified registered voter is expected to vote. And
receives a
financial penalty to pay if he or she does not do the basics of good citizenship, and that is to vote.
Tim Chambliss, he is the Academic Outreach Coordinator for the Hinckley Institute of Politics at the University of Utah. Robert Gerke is a columnist for the Salt Lake Tribune. We have a link to his column about gerrymandering in Utah on our website. That's at radiowest.org. Jen, thanks for the call. 801-585-WEST is the number to join us. We have a few more calls, actually, we'll take when we get back from a break. Or you can send an email, radiowest@kuer.org. Back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we've been talking about redrawing political boundaries, how it works and how it's supposed to work. Let's go back to the phones. Suzanne is joining us from Draper. Suzanne, welcome.
Hi, Doug. Great show. My name is Suzanne Harrison, and I had to call because of your caller that had said that she didn't know why she even bothers voting. She's wondering if she should continue to vote because her vote doesn't matter. I just ran as a challenger to a sitting incumbent down in Sandy Draper in a district that nobody thought a challenger could win. And I came within 5 votes of beating him. And I can't tell you how many times I have heard people say, oh, my vote doesn't matter in Utah. Your vote matters. And if more people actually turned in their ballot and voted, we could have a huge impact in this state. But we need people to be engaged and actually get to know the local candidates and issues and vote.
Suzanne, I'm glad you called. Robert Gerke, I mean, we're all probably familiar with this case, mm-hmm.
LeVar Christensen.
Yeah. By 5 votes, that's pretty remarkable. You were mentioning in your you've mentioned to us before, Craig Hall, another lawmaker, yeah, who has to stay in that boundary, otherwise, you know, it gets fairly close. Though there are competitive races.
Well, and I think Suzanne raises a good Suzanne's case is a good example. I mean, she worked her tail off in that race. And because it wasn't a completely lopsided district, she was able to make this interesting. And I think if in 2 years, if she runs again, or I guess next year, if she runs again, I think people will have to pay attention to it. I think it probably, you know, got LeVar Christensen's attention, you know, and so you look at the cases where these close races, and I think people then have a reason to come out and be involved. Craig Hall is a Republican representative from West Valley, and he's run some very close races. It's one of those districts, one of the few districts that every year or every election cycle is going to be pretty competitive. And as a result, he has to listen to his voters and has to represent all of his voters and not just the delegates. And I think it's an example of what we want to see more of in this system.
Let's go back to the phones. Carrie is joining us in Ogden. Carrie, welcome. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks for taking the call. Yeah, my wife and I, we've talked about this stuff a lot, and I know the gerrymandering issue is one of the big issues that we've had as far as I mean, we live in Utah. I mean, well, why do we have to gerrymander it here in Utah of all states? That's just crazy. And the other thing is the term limit thing. That these politicians get in there, and in Utah, R means religious, like us, and D means devil. And I am of the religion here in the state, but my wife and I both grew up in Republican households where our parents held the caucuses, but we are so fed up with this that my way of dealing with it is I just vote a straight Democratic ticket. It doesn't matter. I mean, it's going to be Republican as it is. My wife takes a little bit of a different view where she will vote for against the incumbent, which is, again, you're voting against the Republican.
But I just, it all adds up to being the same. But,
contrarians.
Yeah.
But I have an issue as far as just the fact that, you know, just because it's legally right does not mean it's morally right. And there's a lot of things in politics that statement applies to, and I just have an issue, and that's how I feel with it.
Yeah. Well, I'm glad you called. Robert, he mentions term limits. That was, some perceive what the lawmakers did with the term limits movement a few years ago as fairly cynical.
Probably one of the, I've been covering politics for about 20 years, and it's probably one of the more cynical things I've seen. To a refresher, I guess, about 1994. There was a voter initiative that was being pushed by Merrill Cook to impose term limits. The legislature stepped in and said, no, we got this. We'll pass some term limits. They passed 12-year term limits, and then 8 years later turned around and repealed them before anybody was actually term limited out of office. The concern, the reason it's sort of telling, I think, is because when there are these voter initiatives like we saw with Count My Vote and like we're seeing now, the legislature tends to try to tinker with them a little bit because they don't want voters to kind of take this into their own hands. And so they'll sometimes step in and try to manipulate it or massage it or, you know, derail it in some way. And so you kind of have to be on guard for that coming with as these move down the pike.
Also in 1994, the U.S. Supreme Court said that it's the people, not the legislative body, that that will make the decision about the term lengths of U.S. senators and members of Congress.
Let me get some final thoughts on all of this. Where do you think this process could go? I mean, it's pretty likely they'll get 113,000 plus signatures, or what do you think?
It costs a lot of money. Yeah. And so that's sort of the big challenge I think that they're facing right now, is trying to, especially when there are other ballot initiatives, trying to get out there and raise the money and get the signatures. You know, you're talking about $1 million to get it, you know, to get the signatures, to get this on the ballot, and then you've got to run a campaign. I don't know if there would be necessarily a strong campaign against it. I would imagine that maybe the Republican Party the state Republican Party would put some money into trying to oppose this.
Do they have any money to do?
They're in debt half of it.
That's
a question.
If they can gin up the money, I guess. We'll put it. I think I don't think it's a slam dunk. And then you've got to, as we've tried to do today, make a case for why voters should care about this and get involved in it. They've got some work ahead of them.
What do you think, Conley?
I think also politically we see the emergence of this new United Utah Party that Jim Bennett and others, Republican and Democrats, are asking unaffiliated and fiercely independent voters to support.
So you think there's a kind of a trend at work that might
we
be
see
good.
Movement.
Yeah.
Movement based upon frustration and dissatisfaction and also hope. Mm-hmm.
Well, hope. That's a good way to end. Tim Chambliss, I'm glad you mentioned that. Tim Chambliss, Academic Outreach Coordinator for the Hinckley Institute of Politics at the University of Utah. Thank you.
Thank you.
For being with us. And Robert Gerke, as always, columnist for the Salt Lake Tribune. So you can find a link to his column. It's really good about gerrymandering on our website.
Aw,
shucks. RadioWest.org or SLTrib.com. Robert, thanks to you.
Thank you.
And thanks to those of you who did call and participated. Grateful. Radio West is a production of KUER News. Technical direction from Tim Slover, the program produced by Benjamin Bombard and Elaine Clark. I'm Doug Fabrizio.